You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokomingua, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ngā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranuja. Efa Akane, coming up on the show, for City Councilling this week, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about council voting to investigate council ties to companies involved in illegal Israeli settlements on Palestinian land and Auckland Council's new AI assistant tool. And I spoke to Sue Coutts, Director of External Affairs at Zero Waste Aotearoa, about a proposal to export New Zealand waste to Fiji for incineration. Pranuja, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halpert about the latest developments in the Iran conflict, rising fuel pressures linked to tensions in the Strait of Hormuz, and the government's response to the recent cyclone events here in Aotearoa. I spoke with Professor Tressa Dunworth from the University of Auckland about recent comments from US President Donald Trump and what these developments could mean from a legal perspective. I also spoke with Associate Professor Jennifer Frost from the University of Auckland about the recent U.S. move to drop the military draft in the U.S. and how it, and broader concerns around power and militarization.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka au e wareware hiana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakeheri rukiruki mārunga i te pai, tukutuki o irirangi pōho, mihaere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Lima Toru Iwa Lima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Warifitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Global tensions remain high this week with a ceasefire in the ongoing US-Iran conflict and renewed escalation around the Strait of Hormuz, raising concerns about global oil supply and rising fuel prices. Here in Aotearoa, severe weather events continue to put pressure on communities, with debate emerging on how and when states of emergency should be declared, following comments from Wairoa's mayor during Cyclone Vianu. For our weekly catch-up with Labour Party's Shannon Halpert, I asked about the government's response to these developments, both internationally and at home. We're about halfway through the two-week ceasefire between the US and Iran, but tensions are clearly still very high. What do you make of where things are right now?
I think it's a pretty sad case of where things are at, and leaders across the world haven't been helpful in that. What's important here is that we need clarity and leadership on what is a major international crisis from our own government, and we're just not getting that.
Do you think the government's doing enough or we're being too cautious?
Well, Prime Minister Luxon couldn't even condemn the bombing of a primary school. He hasn't come out with a very clear plan, and New Zealanders, as a result, are just sitting here waiting in a fuel crisis without any clarity of around what's next. Prices are going up, and that's challenging families on an everyday budget.
And more recently, we've seen US President Donald Trump move to block Iranian shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. How significant is that escalation from your perspective?
Yeah, quite significant. It appears to be quite a step away from diplomacy. In my view, New Zealand shouldn't be involved in that. But it is important that leaders across the world are working together to create an outcome that is reasonably positive for everyone, and that's why diplomacy is so important.
With the Strait of Hormuz being a key global oil route, this is pushing fuel prices up and increasing economic uncertainty. Back home, we're seeing petrol prices rising again, so what's your view on how the government is handling that?
Well, dealing with the fuel crisis should be our government's number one priority right now. They should be pulling out all the stops, working every angle possible to secure as much certainty around fuel supplies as possible. I'm not convinced that they're doing that, and I don't think the everyday New Zealander is convinced that they're doing that. And they just need to be moving faster to explain what will happen in a fuel shortage, because at the end of the day, every New Zealander is feeling the pinch of fuel prices increasing.
Do you think the government is prepared for the flow-on effects, particularly around cost of living?
Well, the government hasn't provided any certainty and clarity for New Zealanders. They've come up with a very light plan, but New Zealanders want to understand what the way forward looks like, how the government is responding to this, and how they're going to prevent fuel prices and the cost of living from increasing as a result. We've seen reports this week that say things could increase by 50%, I think it was. You know, that will be scaring families, working families, and those on benefits in particular, who are struggling to make costs meet at the moment, to get food on the table. Yesterday I was at the Kindness Collective, and they've seen a massive increase in the number of families and agencies asking for help to provide food security to local families here in Tāmaki, Makaurau, Auckland.
How would the Labour Party approach this?
Well, it's important to look back at the Labour Party's approach in COVID. We were very clear in our alert levels. We provided detail around where organisations, where different groups of New Zealanders sat, what the priorities were. There was daily communication going out. And there was a lot of resources and support put in place to support New Zealanders at a time of need, whether you were a business, whether you were a family struggling to get food on your table.
Moving on to Cyclone Vaianu, we've been dealing with severe weather and cyclone impacts. How would you assess the government's response so far?
Well, I was quite glad that people were properly prepared this time. I think communications were excellent by emergency management teams and by local councils. And I'm thankful to all the workers who helped the country prepare for this cyclone. And in my view, it is better to be safe than sorry. But what we need from a government is a real resilience plan. We need to understand why this government hasn't invested in national resilience. What they're doing to prevent flood damage and keep people safe as a result. And this government hasn't prioritised climate change over the past 2.5 years.
And I just wanted to touch on Wairoa Mayor Craig Little's comment that he refused to declare a state of emergency during Cyclone Vaianu, calling the broader response woke and unnecessary. What do you make of these comments?
That's not helpful in my view, but I'm just glad that people were properly prepared this time. I have whānau down in the Hawke's Bay, and I know after previous weather events, you know, they were so fearful for what could happen, and so they were happy to be prepared.
Are our current emergency management systems fit for purpose as these cyclone and weather events become more common?
I'm no expert in this space. But I acknowledge the workers that have been supporting us to date. I think what were 1 in 100 day weather events have now become more frequent, and so it's important that we invest in a proper resilience plan, that we make sure we continually improve our emergency management responses, and we seem to be doing that. But no doubt governments will need to take a leadership approach in that. And that's what I want to see from Prime Minister Luxon.
So with these cyclone and weather events becoming more common, where do you think our biggest gaps are right now in the government's climate response?
Well, the government is running blind. They've underinvested and cut back on investment in our climate change response. We used to be world leaders in some respects. We had good policies to set us up for 2030. But this government has cut those resources back. I look to things like the National Resilience Plan in 2023 that we set up following Cyclone Gabriel. That was a $6 billion investment, and National cut all of that funding.
What would Labor's response be?
Well, you'll see from the past the investment in both climate change response and the national resilience plan. The urgency is for leadership right here and now. We've got families that are doing it tough, that are confused by where the government is taking us, and even if they care. So while the election and policies will come out, you know, over the coming months, urgency means that a government has to respond now. We will hold the government to account, and we will go through to the election with policies that Labor will lead.
When you look at all of this global instability, rising fuel prices and climate events, what do you think the government's top priority should be right now?
The government's top priority should be addressing the fuel crisis. If they don't get on top of this particular issue and show some leadership, then that's going to impact a number of things. People's ability to put food on the table, businesses' ability to operate and keep people employed. And so there are real ripple effects. And if our economy isn't doing well, then people aren't doing well, and it will disable our ability to respond to climate issues in the first place.
That was our weekly catch-up with Shannon Halpert about the latest developments in the Iran conflict, rising fuel pressures linking to the tensions in the Strait of Hormuz, and the government's response to recent cyclone events here in Aotearoa.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halpert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Earlier this week, Councillor Julie Ferry moved a resolution to investigate Auckland Council's involvement with companies that are complicit in Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian territory. On Facebook, Ferry wrote, "Tens of thousands of Aucklanders turned out last year to march in solidarity with the people of Palestine, and the least we can do is check that we are not spending Aucklanders' money, public money, in ways that cause harm and exacerbate war crimes." And this week, Auckland Council launched an AI virtual assistant to report issues such as graffiti, roaming dogs, and noise complaints. It includes features such as Te Reo Māori capability, fact-checking, and photo analysis. For City Counselling this week, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about both of these topics. I started by asking if she could explain the motion that she put forward to investigate council ties to Israel.
Yeah, so what it's about is it goes back to a UN Security Council resolution that was actually put up by New Zealand when Murray McCulley was Foreign Minister, so under a national government, back in 2016, which was about acknowledging the illegal Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian territory and sort of calling out, and agreed to by the international community, calling out that those illegal Israeli settlements are indeed illegal and that basically countries around the world shouldn't do business in ways that enable those illegal Israeli settlements to continue to be there. And of course, in the 10 years since then, they have expanded as well. And so the idea of the notice of motion, which we debated and voted through, was to look at, is Auckland Council associated with using any businesses that are supporting those illegal Israeli settlements? And the UN Human Rights Council, I think it's called, they actually keep a database of those businesses. So, you know, there's a rigorous internationally recognised list, and it's got about 150 to 160 businesses on them. Most of them, of course, only active in that region, but there are a small number that are active internationally. And it's really about council checking, do we use any of these businesses? Because if we do, we are potentially contributing to the support of those illegal Israeli settlements. So it's a very small step to express some solidarity with the people of Palestine and with the ongoing situation that they are in, and make sure that we aren't spending council money, public money, Aucklanders' money, in ways that further that injustice and internationally recognised war crime, basically. So what we did was we debated it and we passed that we will basically check, are we using any of these businesses? And then that advice will come back to a further committee for us to decide what we do about that. So it may be that the advice from staff comes back and says, actually, we're not using any, in which case we may choose to confirm that we will continue to not use any. It may come back and say, actually, we are using some, and this is what the implications would be if we stopped using those. And then councillors will make a decision about, okay, well, should we stop using those? Shouldn't we? That kind of thing. So it's asking for the information to check that list. And my understanding is that staff have actually been able to do that very quickly. It's taken almost no staff time. And so we will probably have that advice back on a committee agenda, I hope, in June for councillors to consider and then vote on next steps. Yeah, but also importantly, although the motion itself was very narrow and very focused on a role that council does have, which is the spending of Aucklanders' money to deliver services to Aucklanders, right? The debate actually gave an opportunity for councillors to express their solidarity more generally to Palestine, to call out a lot of the terrible atrocities that are happening now, not just in Palestine, but also more recently the conflict in Iran and Lebanon, where Israeli government has breached ceasefire agreements and is killing a very large number of people, mostly civilians. And so it gave councillors an opportunity to discuss that publicly, and many chose to express their rejection of the illegal actions of the Israeli government, which I found really heartening that people would go a little bit beyond the scope of the notice of motion and take that opportunity to express their solidarity.
My understanding is that it didn't have universal support from councillors. So what That's were true. Some of the arguments against the motion, and how did you respond to them?
Yeah, so the vote was 14 in favour, 2 against, and then 4 abstentions. The only one of the people who abstained explained why they abstained, and they abstained on the basis, so abstain means neither yes nor no, and they abstained on the basis that they thought it should have gone to a different council committee, which I thought was odd, but that's up to them. So we don't know why the other people abstained, but with the two people who voted against, they did both speak, and basically they saw this as something that wasn't council's business. I found that incredibly frustrating because we had worked for a while to work out how is this relevant to council? How is this international conflict relevant to Auckland Council on the other side of the world? And this was very specifically about how Auckland Council spends its money and the possibility that we might be spending money in a way that is doing harm and enabling further harm in effectively war crime. And so it was very frustrating to me that there was sort of this, oh, well, it's not relevant, we shouldn't be doing this, this is not something where we should take sides. Actually, it was very specifically about how we spend Aucklanders' money. And so, the comment was we should stick to our knitting. And my point was that actually our procurement is literally the needles and the wool that help us to do the knitting. And so we have an obligation to Aucklanders to make sure there is no blood on the knitting. And I was actually really disappointed with the quality of the arguments put up, which was basically, I thought, very poor.
You've touched on this already, but I want to know more. What are the next steps now that the motion has passed? And more specifically, for Aucklanders who are supportive of this motion and are supportive of the work that you're doing in this space, is there anything they can do to show council that they support this?
Yeah, I think the next steps are that we will get this information back from staff. They will have looked at this database list of businesses, looked at who council uses to do all the things that we do, and identified if there's any crossover. My understanding, as I say, is that it they've actually basically already done that, and there's almost none. Where there is potentially some, which was something I'd identified in advance, is in the accommodation booking space. So Airbnb, Booking.com, TripAdvisor, and I think Trivago, so that all those big sort of, you know, multinational accommodation booking sites, they are all active in the illegal Israeli settlements, allowing people to book accommodation in these sites that have been internationally recognised as being illegal. And I don't understand why any business would agree to do that. So that's something we council might need to look at. There may be others I'm not aware of yet, but that's the particular one. So what will come back to a further future council committee is some advice that says, we've checked the lists, the UN list and our list, and these are the crossovers, and if any, and this is what we could do to make sure that we're not using those businesses anymore, and do councillors support us making those changes. That's what I anticipate will come back, probably in June. We originally talked about July, but because it's been so quick for them to do the work, I suspect it will be sooner. So what I would encourage people who are supportive of council not using those businesses, of withdrawing any Aucklanders money from those businesses, with the money that council spends, it would be amazing if you could get in touch with your local ward councillor and tell them that you support Auckland Council withdrawing any money from those businesses, if there are any. And you can work out who your ward councillor is by going to the council website, and you'll see a thing that says, like, find your local board, and you just put your address in and it tells you this is your local board members. They don't have a role in this decision, but it will also tell you who your ward councillors are and how to contact them. So that would be amazing if people could email their ward councillors and say, I support this move, I support Auckland Council not spending money with businesses who are enabling those illegal Israeli settlements. Just a few sentences would be fantastic and would show what I believe is true, which is that there is huge community support for council to take this step.
And I just want to switch tacks now to ask about something else that has happened in council this week. Could you explain the new AI assistant that the council has launched?
Yeah, so this is something that's been worked on in the background for a while. It's been trialled with 1,000 Aucklanders, and elected members have had access to it to sort of try it in the background and stuff before the public launch. So, and council tends to be very risk averse, right? Particularly in the comms space, particularly around this, new technology. We tend to be sometimes a slow follower rather than an early adopter or a fast follower. And there's some political appetite for being a bit better at being a fast follower. And so they've built this virtual assistant called Ask Auckland Council, and if you put that into Google, it'll pop up. And basically at the moment it's focused on allowing people to report six areas where there are commonly problems. So it enables you to report graffiti, illegal dumping, roaming dogs, missed bin collection, so that's your household bin, not the public bins. I accidentally tried to do a public bin yesterday, and noise complaint. So the idea is that you'll be able to do that using this. It makes it really simple and easy, and it can deal with te reo Māori, which most AI tools can't. It's not perfect yet. We are still testing the stuff out, particularly before we expand it to deal with other problems. But if you put in a problem that it can't deal with, it will direct you to the right way to do that. And this is particularly good for illegal dumping, because previously you could only report illegal dumping by phone. It was one of the things that you couldn't use the online report a problem tool for, which is much more arduous, and you sort of have to go through and fill out a bit of a form. It only takes 5 minutes, but 5 minutes is a lot more than the 1 minute that it takes with the Ask Auckland Council tool. So excited to see how that rolls out.
Does it signal that council may use more AI tools in its service delivery in the future?
Possibly. I think there's a healthy scepticism around the council table about AI. I certainly am, not a big fan of... I think using it to automate things I personally would much rather have AI fold my laundry than write a poem. I think we should be looking at it more in that sort of automation and manual space. But we actually are already using AI for things like where we have CCTV, actually pulling up, you know, having the ability to have AI looking at all the thousands of images that might be coming in, say, for example, from storm drains, and pull up and draw to the attention of a human being, hey, this one here, there's something encroaching within the square that the AI is set to monitor, and that sort of gives us a backup. We've been looking at doing that with things like train platforms. If people are getting too close to the edge of the train platform, again, it pulls up that screen, brings it to the attention of a human being who makes sure a guard goes down and says, hey, you know, checks on people's safety. So I think there's some real value in that type of space, where there's huge amounts of visual images in particular coming in, and the AI can make sure that the human being who's looking at things doesn't miss them. But when it comes to things like, for example, the massive amount of highly technical submissions on Plan Change 120, the ability of AI to actually give you a useful summary of that is very limited. So AI is being used in that case to check things, but still, every submission needs to be read and coded by a human being because of the nature of that work.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on Council voting to investigate council ties to companies involved in illegal Israeli settlements on Palestinian land and Auckland Council's new AI assistant tool.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Councilling on 95BFM.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Armageddon. It's the most exciting gaming and pop culture event of the year. And if you are a wielder of the all-powerful B card, then you could win tickets. So stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all week for your cue to enter. Armageddon, Anzac Long Weekend, April 25th till the 27th at the Auckland Showgrounds. Get your tickets now at iticket.co.nz or on the door.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling the bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95BFM.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums and more.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
As the conflict between the United States, Israel and Iran continues to unfold, concerns are growing not just about escalation, but about what this means for international law. Recent comments from U.S. President Donald Trump have drawn criticism from legal experts, with some warning that this rhetoric could have serious implications in terms of war crimes and accountability. Last week, I spoke with Professor Tressa Dunworth from the University of Auckland about how these developments are being viewed through an international law lens and what role countries like New Zealand should be playing in response. Now, you've said Trump's recent comments could add potential genocide to existing war crimes. What makes this rhetoric so serious? Is it a cause for concern?
It is a cause for concern because language does matter, and that's why we have these different crimes, so war crimes or genocide or crimes against humanity. So words do matter, and genocide is generally considered to be one of the most serious of the international crimes.
When we talk about something like genocide or crimes against humanity, what are the legal requirements that define it a war crime as opposed to just any sort of military movement?
So a war crime is something that breaches the rules of law, the rules of war. So, for example, killing a single civilian, deliberately targeting a civilian, would be a war crime. A crime against humanity is broadly understood as mass killings or mass destruction. So it has the concept of much more than one. Genocide is in another category again. So it's mass killing, although it doesn't have to be, well, it's mass killing. But the key thing about genocide is that there has to be an intent to wipe out a community of people, whether that's on racial grounds, religious grounds, cultural or ethnic grounds. And so therefore, that's why Trump's civilization comment squarely puts it within the notion of genocide.
New Zealand has called for de-escalation but has stopped short from directly condemning the US and the president's comments. Do you think that this response is strong enough?
No.
And what is your view on Winston Peter and his meeting with the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio?
Well, I mean, it was the comment, the civilization, wipe out the civilization comment had already been made. But I feel like New Zealand, the whole way through Israel's genocide in Gaza and now right through this conflict, New Zealand hasn't met its international obligations to criticize or try to contribute to the de-escalation of the conflict. And I say that it's an international obligation because these crimes are so serious that all states, including New Zealand, have an obligation to try and condemn them, to try and de-escalate. But when you go to Washington and you shake hands with people, in the center of the administration, that's not criticizing. That's not, that's almost could be seen as condoning.
How should countries like New Zealand balance our international partnerships with upholding international law?
Well, you know, there probably isn't a general answer to that question because it would depend in any situation, but there would be opportunities to express concern, call in the ambassador. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff that we should be doing. And I appreciate that the Iran war is a little newer, but in terms of the Gaza situation, you know, we haven't got sanctions against Israel. We haven't got, we didn't change our immigration law to allow Palestinian refugees the ease of entry, if we say compared to Ukrainian refugees and so on. So there's a lot of ways that we could have expressed our disapproval and our condemnation. And we did in some statements in the United Nations do that, but not really calling out Israel's actions or certainly the actions of the United States.
There's been discussion around the potential establishment of an FBI office here in New Zealand. How does that play into the overall political situation, particularly when it comes to the independence and accountability of New Zealand?
Well, I would be concerned about that because already being involved in the Five or remaining involved in the Five Eyes program is concerning because to what extent is the intelligence being gathered there, being shared with the United States, who are clearly, it's well understood and accepted that they unshare to Israel in terms of their targeting information. So I would be more than concerned about any notion of an FBI office here or becoming any closer to, intelligence networks.
With the recent comments, what does this situation say about the current state of a rules-based international order?
I think that we're selective about what we mean when we say rules-based international order, and that's very concerning. So some rules we like to rely on, and then other rules we turn away from their breach.
For people listening, why does this kind of legal framing actually matter beyond the courtroom in an international context?
It matters because of what we're actually seeing unfolding now is that international law matters. So if we say that international law doesn't matter at all, then here we have it. Then why can't the Americans just take out the whole Persian civilization? That's why it matters. So I'm not saying that international law doesn't have its own blind spots, its own imperial tendencies. It absolutely does. And I'm not saying that international law, like any other law, like our laws about, criminal assaults here in Aotearoa, but without it, we're in a state of anarchy.
What's the key thing you think New Zealand should be doing differently right now?
The key thing New Zealand should be doing differently right now is at least expressing disapproval to the Americans and the Israelis.
That was Professor Tressa Dunworth from the University of Auckland about recent comments from US President Donald Trump and what these developments could mean for international law.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Australian company TNG Limited has proposed an incinerator in the Sawini beachside area of Fiji. The application specifically cites New Zealand as a source of waste for the incinerator, which would burn 900,000 tonnes of waste per year. This is more than four times the amount of waste that Fiji itself produces. Concerns have been raised about the impact on the local environment, hazardous materials, and air emissions. Issues have also been raised about heritage and dignity. The site of the proposed incinerator, Ngāi Korokoro Point, is the ancestral arrival site for the people of the Vuda district. I spoke to Sue Coutts, Director of External Affairs at Zero Waste Aotearoa, about this proposed incinerator. I started by asking if she could explain who Zero Waste Aotearoa is and what they do for those who don't know.
Yeah, I'm Sue Coutts from Zero Waste Aotearoa. We're an organisation that has members right across the country who are into reuse, repair, recycling and composting in their communities. And then we also do quite a lot of advocacy, just trying to shift our world to a more low-waste, low-carbon, economy. So that's why we're interested in this incineration proposal.
And why are you concerned about New Zealand exporting waste to Fiji? And how has this discussion arisen?
Well, what's happened is there's a big incinerator being proposed for Fiji. There was a company that was looking to set up a facility, like a big incineration facility, to burn rubbish in Sydney, and they were turned down over there. And so they've taken their proposal over to Fiji and they're proposing bringing rubbish from Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, other Pacific Islands to Fiji and burning it there. We think that's a crazy idea. The incinerator is set up, that they're talking about setting up, is going to burn 900,000 tonnes of waste every year, and that's more than four times what Fiji produces itself each year. We know that incinerators, where they're being used in other parts of the world, they generate a lot of toxic ash, so Fiji is going to end up with a much bigger problem to deal with than they've already got if this incinerator proposal goes ahead. We don't think New Zealanders should be sending our rubbish across to Fiji to make it their problem. So then the Fijians just end up with having to deal with a problem that we've created, and that's not a fair way of going about things.
And I want to ask, obviously you've been advocating against this in New Zealand, but has there been an opposition movement from people inside Fiji?
Yes, there is. Yeah, the Fijians really coming out against it, and you know, the local people are saying, you know, this is a beautiful area. We've got plans and, you know, the potential to develop it for tourism and something which is much more sustainable economic development for Fiji. If an incinerator is built there, then that's going to really make that, you know, a lot harder. You know, not that many people want to go on a holiday to a beautiful beachside location and sit beside a giant incinerator that's huffing out toxic emissions. Everyone from the rugby clubs over there coming out against it, they're saying, you know, they really don't want to see Australia sending their rubbish to Fiji for them to deal with. And we've got quite strong opposition over there from a lot of people who are working together. The Prime Minister, Sirivini Rabuka, has also said he understands the concerns and he doesn't support the project proceeding. You know, they're basically saying, we don't want to be the ashtray for Australia and New Zealand. We don't want you guys to be dumping your waste on us.
And what are some alternatives to this proposal?
Well, I think the thing that we're seeing around the world is a lot of the wealthy countries where people consume a lot, use a lot of stuff, throw a lot of stuff away, you know, create a lot of rubbish in their lifestyles where they're, you know, buying short life products and then use them for not very long and then toss them out. You know, really we've got to have a good hard think about that process or, you know, that way of life. A lot of people don't really know much about where things come from. You know, often the producer, the way clothing, household goods are produced overseas creates problems for people in those countries in terms of pollution and environmental damage and often, you know, not very good social relations, people working in the factories producing all that stuff and then use them for a very short time and then we throw them away. All of the same things happen, you know, there's problems either in our country or with landfill and with these incinerator proposals that are popping up around New Zealand. And then, now I've got this idea of sending it away overseas. So there isn't really some magical away place that we can send all this stuff. We have to start thinking about how we can reduce our consumption and take a bit more responsibility.
And is there anything else you would want people to know about this issue?
Well, I think the thing that's really important to understand is it's part of a long-term pattern. A lot of your listeners might not remember that in the 70s, New Zealanders really stood up against the idea of nuclear testing in the Pacific, which created a lot of long-term harm for, countries over there out in the Pacific where they were testing nuclear weapons. Bigger countries did that because they thought it was better to pollute someone else's country and not their own, and these incinerator proposals are the same sort of thing. You know, it's just we really need to stand up against these kinds of toxic incinerators being set out into countries which have weaker regulations or less rules about how things might work, and we have to really stick by our Pacific neighbours and help them to fight for clean, you know, solutions. If they're saying they're going to spend $1 billion on this incinerator, if they spend $1 billion on solar and wind, that would set Fiji up with really great renewable energy source. That's exactly the opposite of what an incinerator would do.
That was Sue Coutts, Director of External Affairs at Zero Waste Aotearoa, on a proposal to export New Zealand waste to Fiji for incineration.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is some Commie and Marlon Williams.
Taipo, keiko tonu to kore kiri mohio. Oro ake, nei te aue, hei poro poro aki i te kaue. Ka Katarina, kako whakawiri, whakakaru karu tuku whakairi, iri. Tupatora I te parawahahu, oro kia te te rokora kika tono. Kei kokoa, tō mana, kei tinea, tō rama. Tōna haka aroha hoki koi nā te take tauheke ai oi e kore tipu ake e kore e mā tūtū e kore rai ora ake nā wai rā ka marama I a koe Hoki atu hoki taku tohi whenua tērā taku kai katoa rua ma te kai katahi maroro noha tahi rana I tau ake tau Tūra tūkiri kau Ko taku whirika kia matoha nei au Takohia tūra tūkiri kau Ko taku whirika kia matoha nei au Ara he kawa I tētahi rā He reka rawa atu I tētahi atu rā Koira te matiki tēnā Tūroro whai take aro kore Karoko a me whai te tika ka whaka kone kone He arero kare ao ka whati e ka rito Ārero kaore e whati Aere tonu ana e kati E arero kare au ka whati E karito ārero kaore e whati Aere tonu ana e kati Hoki atu hoki taku tohi whenua Tērā taku kai katoa rua Ma te kai katahi maroro noha Tai rā nai tau ake tau rāroa Hoki atu hoki taku tohi whenua Tērā taku kai katoa rua Ma te kai katahi maroro noha Tai rā nai tau ake tau rāroa
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
Amid rising global tensions, the United States is set to introduce an automatic draft registration later this year, meaning eligible young men will be added to the system using government data rather than having to sign up themselves. I spoke with Associate Professor Jennifer Frost from the University of Auckland about what this shift signals and how it connects to broader political movements and concerns within the United States.
So the US is set to introduce an automatic draft registration later this year, meaning eligible young men will be added to the system without having to sign up themselves. How significant is this shift in your view?
I think it is quite significant because, as you say, it means that you move from a voluntary, if expected or required, system of registering for the military draft to an automatic one. And one of the reasons why they are doing this is because something like only 42% of 18-year-old men in 2024 actually went ahead and complied with that requirement to register for the military draft. And so the, you know, federal government wants to have greater participation from more young men. And interestingly, this was passed by Congress as part of the National Defense Appropriation Act in December of last year, and it was signed by Trump. So this is something that actually came from Congress. And what has brought it to attention is that last month, the Trump administration sent forward basically a rule request to get the rule to be approved and then effective in December. So it's coming into attention at this point because of that rule request, but also obviously right in the middle of the U.S.'s war on Iran.
And we last spoke to you about the No Kings movement. How do you see these new developments around this registration fitting into that political movement?
Oh, it fits into it absolutely, because it's another example of the overreach and the incursion into people's lives by this Trump regime. So, for example, one of the things they're going to do is they're going to establish a database that puts every young man, male child, into the database from birth, and then is going to track them and follow up with them. And so you can argue it's an invasion of privacy. It's also, they're going to rely on a gender assignment at birth that also we know is not something that is necessarily going to be accurate. And in fact, some feminist groups have opposed this, saying, why is it only, cisgender men who are being included and not cisgender women, et cetera. So there's a lot of pushback from pacifist groups, from religious groups, from anti-war groups, from civil liberties groups, as well as feminist groups.
Now, the U.S. isn't reintroducing mandatory conscription, but it is moving to an automatic registration, making it easier for young men to enlist. What message do you think this sends, especially at a time of rising global tensions?
It is a very scary message, and I think that's why you do have this opposition from, something like 40 different groups have come together to oppose this rule request. And also, I think we've got to remember that the last time that the U.S. had a military draft was during the Vietnam War that ended in 1973. And that war as well was understood by opponents to be an illegal and unconstitutional war, because there never was a declaration of war from Congress to approve the American war in Vietnam. And we're in the same situation now, where the Trump regime has pursued their war in Iran without congressional approval, without a declaration of war. And so this is consolidating power in the hands of the executive branch in the Trump regime. It's a violation of the Constitution, and it shows that the rule of law and the Constitution is not in effect in the United States.
For young people in particular, what do you think this moment represents in terms of trust in a government or in political engagement?
I think it shows a lot of distrust. I mean, even across the population as a whole, only 24% of Americans in the last poll approve of this war in Iran. 24%, right? So three quarters are opposing this war, or at the very least neutral on this war. And so to have this at the same time, this unconstitutional, illegal, unpopular war is being pursued with, and we can criticize the war in various other ways, the lack of strategy, the lack of any concrete goals or purpose that's been laid out by the Trump regime. At the same time this is happening, you have this rule request that is definitely frightening young people, because just like with Vietnam, they don't want to go and fight a war that they are critical of and that they oppose.
Should we be concerned in New Zealand about expanding power or militarization in the U.S.?
Yes, I think so. I mean, one of the arguments of the critics of this is that by making it easier to find young men, in this case, to draft into the military, you actually ease the process for military planning. And that is, you know, kind of encourages or can lead to greater military intervention. And in fact, one of the things we think or has been hypothesized, the limits on the current war in terms of boots on the ground or, you know, an invasion of troops is a lack of numbers. So if you have greater numbers of, you know, military servicemen ready to go, you know, is that going to encourage greater military intervention? So it's, you know, coming right at this point in time. And I think what's interesting is when this was passed by Congress in December and signed by Trump, at that point, you didn't hear much about the opposition. It's that it's coming at this precise moment when we're seeing the dangers of this unfettered Trump regime in terms of using military power. And so this is when the pushback is really coming.
What's the key thing you think people outside of the U.S., including here in New Zealand, should be paying attention to?
Well, I think this is part and parcel of everything that we've been, you know, paying attention to over the last, you know, year and more. And, you know, you mentioned the No Tyrants protests that have been ongoing in the United States and around the world, is that this regime is unfettered in its power. I mean, the courts are trying to do, in some ways, push back. The people are trying in protest, et cetera, to push back. But Congress, under Republican control, isn't doing enough. And so we are seeing an out-of-control Trump regime that has, you know, unlimited power, no checks and balances being used against it, or barely. And we're seeing that impact in how this terrible war is affecting both the people of Iran and the people in the, you know, the Gulf region, but also how it's affecting the global economy too. So the power of the United States, it still is the most powerful country in the world. And, you know, in the hands of this chaotic, you know, unconstitutional, illegal administration or regime is profound for everybody around the world.
That was Associate Professor Jennifer Frost from the University of Auckland about the new American automatic draft registration and how it connects to broader concerns around U.S. militarization.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in, and thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Julie Feary, University of Auckland's Teresa Dunworth, Zero Waste Aotearoa's Sue Coots, and University of Auckland's Jennifer Frost. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.